Grant was aware of serious speculation in laboratories in Berkeley, Tokyo, and London that it might eventually be possible to clone an extinct animal such as a dinosaur if you could get some dinosaur DNA to work with. The problem was that all known dinosaurs were fossils, and the fossilization destroyed most DNA, replacing it with inorganic material. Of course, if a dinosaur was frozen, or preserved in a peat bog, or mummified in a desert environment, then its DNA might be recoverable. But nobody had ever found a frozen or mummified dinosaur, so cloning was therefore impossible. There was nothing to clone from. All the modern genetic technology was useless. It was like having a Xerox copier, but nothing to copy with it. Ellie said, "You can't reproduce a real dinosaur because you can't get real dinosaur DNA." "Unless there's a way we haven't thought of," Grant said.
"Like what?" she said.
"I don't know," Grant said. Beyond a fence, they came to the swimming pool, which spilled over into a series of waterfalls and smaller rocky pools. The area was planted with huge ferns. "Isn't this extraordinary?" Ed Regis said. "Especially on a misty day, these plants really contribute to the prehistoric atmosphere. These are authentic Jurassic ferns, of course." Ellie paused to look more closely at the ferns. Yes, it was just as he said. Sirena veriformans, a plant found abundantly in fossils more than 200 million years old, now common only in the wetlands of Brazil and Colombia. But whoever had decided to place this particular fern at poolside obviously didn't know that the spores of veriformans contained a deadly beta-carboline alkaloid. Even touching the attractive green fronds could make you sick. And if a child were to take a mouthful, he would almost certainly die. The toxin was 50 times more poisonous than oleander. People were so naive about plants, Ellie thought. They just chose plants for appearance, as they would choose a picture for the wall. It never occurred to them that plants were actually living things, busily performing all the living functions of respiration, ingestion, excretion, reproduction, and defense. But Ellie knew that in the Earth's history, plants had evolved as competitively as animals, and in some ways more fiercely. The poison in Sirena veriformans was a minor example of the elaborate chemical arsenal of weapons that plants had evolved. There were terpenes, which plants spread to poison the soil around them and inhibit competitors. Alkaloids, which made them unpalatable to insects and predators and children. And pheromones, used for communication. When a Douglas fir tree was attacked by beetles, it produced an antifeedant chemical, and so did other Douglas firs in distant parts of the forest. It happened in response to a warning allelochemical secreted by the trees that were under attack. People who imagined that life on Earth consisted of animals moving against a green background seriously misunderstood what they were seeing. That green background was busily alive. Plants grew, moved, twisted, and turned, fighting for the sun. And they interacted continuously with animals, discouraging some with bark and thorns, poisoning others, and feeding still others to advance their own reproduction, to spread their pollen and seeds. It was a complex, dynamic process which she never ceased to find fascinating, and which she knew most people simply didn't understand. But if planting deadly ferns at poolside was any indication, then it was clear that the designers of Jurassic Park had not been as careful as they should have been. "Isn't it just wonderful?" Ed Regis was saying. "If you look up ahead, you'll see our safari lodge." Ellie saw a dramatic low building with a series of glass pyramids on the roof. "That's where you'll all be staying here in Jurassic Park." Grant's suite was done in beige tones, the rattan furniture and green jungle print motifs. The room wasn't quite finished. There were stacks of lumber in the closet and pieces of electrical conduit on the floor. There was a television set in the corner with a card on top. Channel 2, Hypsilophodont Highlands. Channel 3, Triceratops Territory. Channel 4, Sauropod Swamp. Channel 5, Carnivore Country. Channel 6, Stegosaurus South. Channel 7, Velociraptor Valley. Channel 8, T Pterosaur Peak. He found the names irritatingly cute. Grant turned on the television but got only static. He shut it off and went into his bedroom, tossed his suitcase on the bed. Directly over the bed was a large pyramidal skylight. It created a tented feeling, like sleeping under the stars. Unfortunately, the glass had to be protected by heavy bars so that striped shadows fell across the bed. Grant paused. He had seen the plans for the lodge, and he didn't remember bars on the skylight. In fact, these bars appeared to be a rather crude addition. A black steel frame had been constructed outside the glass walls, and the bars welded to the frame. Puzzled, Grant moved from the bedroom to the living room. His window looked out on the swimming pool. "By the way, those ferns are poison," Ellie said, walking into his room. "But did you notice anything about the rooms, Alan?"
"They changed the plans."
"I think so, yes." She moved around the room. "The windows are small," she said, "and the glass is tempered, set in a steel frame. The doors are steel clad. That shouldn't be necessary. And did you see the fence when we came in?"
Grant nodded.
The entire lodge was enclosed within a fence with bars of inch-thick steel. The fence was gracefully landscaped and painted flat black to resemble wrought iron, but no cosmetic effort could disguise the thickness of the metal or its 12-foot height.
"I don't think the fence was in the plans either," Ellie said. "It looks to me like they've turned this place into a fortress."
Grant looked at his watch. "We'll be sure to ask why," he said. "The tour starts in 20 minutes."